The Legal Sunday, Part 4, Supplementary. Querical Slumming, Supplementary. The Distinction Between Immorality and Incivility, and Between Vice and Crime, with Some Observations on Clerical Slumming. While this work was preparing for the press, it was suggested to the author by some intelligent supporters of its main thesis that it might be useful to elucidate at greater length the distinction between morality and civility in relation to government, and also timely, as well as germane to the topic, to say a few words about that strange fad of the day known as clerical slumming. It is a fact that the law has, in more than one instance, undertaken to enter the domain of morals and to control the conduct of the citizens irrespective of its civil aspects. But it is nonetheless a fact, in the opinion of the best publicists, that it has made a mistake in so doing, and a mistake which should be rigidly confined to its existing manifestations. These manifestations are found in laws which provide for the punishment of acts classified by Blackstone as offenses against God and religion, and in laws which our later codes say are directed against vice and immorality. But our Brownist cleric comes back at us with this retort: why should you deny me my law against immorality because, as you say, it cannot be enforced? Conceding this to be true, would its acceptance as an argument not involve the reasoning away of all law? You have laws against murder and theft and numerous other crimes, yet these crimes are constantly committed. Would not your argument require you to urge the repeal of all such laws on the ground that they cannot be enforced and ought not, therefore, to exist as laws? Indeed, is there a law on the statute book which would not have to go if non-enforceability at all times is a conclusive objection to it? This very line of reasoning has been more than once adopted to break the force of the pretty generally admitted statement that prohibition does not prohibit. Its refutation is as follows. 1. The American principle being that government is best which governs least, we will have in America the fewest possible laws, and no law that is not absolutely necessary. Laws against crimes, as murder and theft, are absolutely necessary in every organized society. But an organized society may exist and flourish without laws against vice. 2. The non-enforceability of a law is unquestionably a misfortune. It is inevitable, however, from the imperfection of human machinery and of human nature itself. But nothing tends to encourage a fatal disrespect for the law as a whole so grievously as the existence of a statute that cannot be enforced. And this consideration furnishes an all-sufficient reason, apart from the American principle of least possible government, why we should have the very smallest number of laws that we can get along with, and no law whatever which is not absolutely necessary. 3. The non-enforceability of laws against crime and the non-enforceability of laws against vice is alike in kind, because it is an attribute of all law. But there is a difference in degree, and this is what led to the use of the words reasonably enforceable. And for this difference in degree, there are good reasons now to be elucidated. Among the most important of these reasons is the difference between the view taken of vice and the view taken of crime by the community at large. There is a general consensus about crimes and a general agreement that they ought to be suppressed. Everybody feels a personal interest in the detection and punishment of a murderer. Everybody will join in the cry, "Stop, thief!" But there is no such general consensus about vice. The avowed views of people on this subject are, as already intimated, of almost infinite variety, and many confess that they hold two sets of views about it. One, the exoteric, or that which they keep for public exhibition, and the other, their esoteric, or private or confidential view, which is more satisfactory to their own mind. Again, while, as said, everyone feels a personal interest in the criminal doings of his locality, no one, except those who make a life business of setting others straight, really feels that he has any right to meddle with his neighbor's vices, unless some personal relation exists. And even where this does exist, there is, with other than professional reformers, an instinctive appreciation that the meddling of one man with another in this regard is rightfully limited to soft persuasion alone, as was the brotherly way of the master. An ordinary man will not hesitate for an instant to use force to detain a fleeing murderer, or to protect himself or another from robbery, but he would never think of employing force to restrain a fellow man from indulging in vices of his predilection. And, as he would not think of employing his own physical force for any such purpose, so his right instinct tells him that he has no business to invoke the force of the state for any such purpose, and that its legitimate application is confined to protecting him against those things, and those things only, against which it allows him on emergency to protect himself or another by the use of his own force. Prosecutions for vice, then, as distinguished from prosecutions for crime, are weakened by reason of the difference between the view taken of vice and the view taken of crime by the average man. But perhaps a more serious cause of this comparative weakness is the distinction made between vice and crime by those who are charged with the work of criminal administration. Among these officials, there is a very general and strongly settled conviction that prosecutions for vice are futile, if not worse. Their view is that vice depends on a law of supply and demand practically too strong for human law. Hence, we find that police departments everywhere trouble themselves little with the vices of the community and confine their energies almost exclusively to the repression of crime. Tradition and experience alike have led them to this conclusion, that whereas crime may be practically suppressed, vice may be harried and driven from place to place indefinitely, without its aggregate extent or prevalence being materially affected. Of course, the church has here a work to perform in producing such a state of mind among the citizens that the demand for, and consequently the supply of, vice will cease. That she can never fully perform it under the present dispensation, we are told by the Master, who has left word that the wheat and the tares must grow together till he comes again. All that she can do is to strive with all her might and so be found at her post, fighting still, on the day when her victory comes with him. The view that vice is practically irrepressible by police power, which is a postulate of thought among the controlling spirits of all police departments, is of course fully concurred in by their subordinates, down to the rawest patrolman. An officer usually goes upon a new beat inhabited by vicious people without the slightest idea that he will be any more efficient than his predecessor in restraining their vicious propensities. And if he makes a spasmodic and despairing effort to distinguish himself by pulling disorderly houses, he is apt to find his results disheartening and to have his zeal depreciated by his superiors. As a mere outcome of police experience in all ages and every place, then, the initiation of prosecutions for vice, the preliminary arrests, etc., are left to private enterprise and come to be the work of societies and special agents. A society formed for doing any part of the work which police experience pronounces impossible, for suppressing vice of any kind, whatever its specific name may be, is generically to be known as a society for setting others straight. Now, the substitution of the machinery of a private society for the machinery of the great public society, the state, in a prosecution, the attempt to turn the force of the state against an individual by other means than those regularly in operation for that purpose, and which are presumably employed by the regular officials whenever social expediency demands, this thing is likely to prejudice a case in the eyes of the average man. He perceives at once that the activity of the professional reformers who constitute the society is not due to any injury which has been done to them by the vicious act. The same instinct which makes him feel that it is none of his business to forcibly interfere with his neighbor's vices makes him feel that the professional reformer should not be encouraged in his intermeddling with the vices of other people. He finds, as said, a regularly constituted system of administration, the result of the experience of ages, for the express purpose of originating and conducting prosecutions. He is apt to inquire with a note of sarcasm how this came to be the business of the professional reformer. Sometimes the average man will go so far as to intimate that it would be a good thing for the professional reformer to go home and use a strong mirror and pick out the moral beam from his own eye before undertaking to remove the moral motes from the eyes of other people. and thus the professional reformer who instigates prosecutions for vice is discredited, and the prosecutions are weakened in advance. It is evident that cases which have to be worked up by private enterprise, without the cordial assistance and even with the strong disfavor of the police department, are likely to be weak and ineffectual in their preparation. The complaint that the special agents, or the detectives of a society for setting others straight, are not cordially aided, but are rather condemned by the police in their undertaking, is probably, as a rule, well-founded. It is not to be expected that the police should admit that the private detectives of the society can by any possibility succeed where police machinery has always failed. So that the detective's errand is absurd, and his presence is something of an insult to the department as a whole and the individual patrolman whose beat he invades, because it suggests a duty unperformed, which is to the police mind an unfair imputation, the thing in question, the suppression of vice, being not possible of performance. It is true that the private detective of the Society for Setting Others Straight may, in time, become so expert at his business as to be practically independent of police countenance or help. But, whatever degree of weakness in the preparation may thus in time be eliminated, there remains always, apparently irremediable, an essential weakness of presentation in prosecutions for vice. However skillful and complete the work of securing the evidence, it is detective work. However clear and conclusive the testimony, it is detective testimony. Nor is it any less detective work and testimony because, as sometimes happens, see post, it is done out of pure zeal and without compensation. Witnesses, in respect of their attitude toward a case, may be divided into two classes, the willing and the unwilling. A case has an essential element of weakness about it, which has to depend, in whole or in part, on the testimony of unwilling witnesses. That prosecutions for vice are peculiarly unfortunate in this regard, we shall see presently. It is important now to note that they are equally unfortunate, to say the least, in the character and attitude of their willing witnesses. Absolutely the only willing witnesses in prosecutions for vice are detectives. If the professional reformer has done his own detective work and is, therefore, a witness in the case, as well as an instigator of the prosecution, his character as a generally well-behaved citizen is almost merged and lost in his character as a busybody and in his character of voluntary detective. The judgment of the average man is against detective evidence. While it is generally conceded that the detective business is necessary for the suppression of crime, the detective as a witness is by equally general impulse mistrusted. It is considered that his occupation tends to harden him to deceit. And even the professional detective employed by the state, though he has no special interest in any one class of cases, is naturally zealous to vindicate his own skill and acuteness in every prosecution. How much stronger is the self-interest of the professional reformer when he does his own detective work, and the vindication of his voluntary assumption of that function, unpleasant in the eyes of all men, depends on the result of his activity, on his ability to convict the wretch whom he has run to earth. And this zeal is by no means diminished by the passionate desire for self-vindication. Deep in the inmost consciousness of every professional reformer of whose own reform there is any hope, lurks the feeling that his work and testimony as a volunteer detective are viewed with just disfavor by the average man. That he has been about an unworthy business, that he has stooped to dishonorable courses, and that his moral tone and dignity have suffered in the process, these are the words of his conscience ringing in his ears, however tightly and ingeniously they be stuffed. Nor is he unaware that the temptation to color his testimony is strong upon him, while he is the feebler to resist it for what he has gone through. All things considered, then, it is not surprising that the professional reformer, as a volunteer detective witness, should view unequally and with distorted vision the facts with which he has to deal, and should magnify this and minimize that, so as to present these facts distortedly and unequally to others. But the organizers of a society for setting others straight do not, as a rule, do their own detective work. They hire others to do it for them. They themselves have neither time, capacity, nor, for the most part, to their high credit be it said, the inclination, voluntarily, to take upon themselves the degrading task of dogging their neighbor's footsteps. So they organize their society and hold meetings and make speeches and get themselves elected presidents and vice presidentesses and international corresponding secretaries of the Southwestern branch and all that sort of thing, and have their names printed in the papers besides. And then they raise a fund. The fund is seldom large enough for the work, which, indeed, grows by what it feeds on, and the new Society for Setting Others Straight, as a rule, soon joins the great army of regular looters of the public treasury. But this is not invariably the case. However, the fund being raised, the principal use of it is to hire special agents, otherwise detectives, to do the work of the society. The collection of the evidence is the business of these detectives. The only testimony willingly given in prosecutions for vice falls from their lips. Their business and their testimony are certainly rightly viewed with disfavor and distrust by the average man. They are not selected from the law-abiding, conscientious, industrious mass of the people. A certain moral callousness is necessary for what they have to do. They are usually shrewd fellows, with a dislike for work, and a strong inclination for that lying around doing nothing in particular, which is rather more characteristic of the average detective when he is on duty than when he is off, and which, it must be admitted, is incidental to his success. Moreover, these shrewd and lazy fellows understand well that their bread and butter, so nicely earned by lying around, depends on the satisfaction they give their employers, that is to say, on their ability to find what they are sent to seek, and to convince judges and juries that they have found it. Average human nature would not keep a witness strictly impartial and strenuously accurate under such temptation as this. And the human nature of the private detective is below, and not above, the average. And the terror is stronger upon him than it is upon the average man at the prospect of having to cease lying around and go to sawing wood. Prosecutions for vice, then, are weak in the character of their willing witnesses. How much weaker, and how altogether ineffectual must they become when, as in almost all cases, the state, to make out its case completely, has to rely on the testimony of witnesses who are altogether unwilling either to appear or to testify, whose wrath is aroused by the very summons. In the case of crimes where the injured party is reluctant to testify, it is the general rule that a non-pros is entered. The wisdom of this policy may be questionable, but it often has its excuse in the fact that conviction is extremely difficult where the injury has been forgiven. How much more difficult must it be where the chief witness for the state has not been injured at all, where he himself participated more or less directly in the act and had to be dragged into court, as it were, by the professional reformers, and where he testifies to each detail with the utmost unwillingness, so that often, after he is dragged into court, the testimony has to be dragged out of him. Let us illustrate the difference between a prosecution for crime and a prosecution for vice, using for the latter our old friend the Sunday law, since we have shown that Blackstone is right in classifying Sabbath breaking, waiving the question of what this may be, as an act of vice and immorality. A enters the store of B on Saturday and robs it. He is arrested as he is leaving with his plunder by a policeman. B is grateful to the officer. No dragging is necessary to get B before the magistrate, the grand jury, or the criminal court. His personal equation throughout is at the service of the state. The only unwilling party in the case is A, and all the dragging necessary is done to him. This is the case of a crime. On the other hand, A enters the store of B on Sunday and purchases a cravat. Unless A be the agent of a self-constituted Society for Setting Others Straight, the arrest in such a case comes about as follows. The policeman may see the purchase made through an open window, but he is not likely to interfere. An agent of the Society for Setting Others Straight is lurking in the neighborhood, playing the spy on those who are doing him no harm. He tracks the purchaser home and gets his name and address, and in a short time the purchaser finds himself summoned to testify against the seller and to aid in the work of punishing a man who has not only done him no harm, but has actually done him an accommodation in selling him something which he wanted at the very time at which he happened to want it, and which perhaps he could not at that time have procured elsewhere without considerable inconvenience. Here we appreciate at once the absence of the personal equation. We see that the state must make out its case by the mouths of professional detectives, whose standing with the busybodies who pay their salaries depends upon the finding just what these last send them to seek, or else at the mouths of unwilling and grudging witnesses, whose testimony must be extorted from them as though on cross-examination, whose whole interest, aim, and purpose is to defeat the side for which they are summoned, and who are almost as anxious for an acquittal as the prisoner himself. No lawyer who properly valued his reputation would cheerfully go into the trial of a civil case with the evidence of such witnesses as his sole reliance and vital to his side. But the prosecuting attorney who is compelled to go to trial of a case thus weak in the character of its witnesses, willing and unwilling, finds also in the weakness of its origin a strong temptation to him to be lukewarm and indifferent in his conduct of it. Like the policeman, he cannot fail to see in the existence and activity of the Society for Setting Others Straight a reflection upon him and his official conduct. "We have gone to the grand jury and are now here," says the Society, in effect, to him and to the public, "because you have neglected your duty in failing to proceed against these people." Such is, in effect, what the officers and special agents of the Society say to him in court, in the presence of the public. And leading men of such a society are often explicit on this point in carefully prepared newspaper interviews. The prosecuting attorney, like the policeman, feels this keenly. Like the policeman, too, he feels that the reflection cast upon him is really unmerited. He, too, is pretty thoroughly convinced of the futility of such prosecutions, and therefore regards them as mere wasting of time and vain beating of the air, a point of view from which no man sets out with reasonable prospect of success in an undertaking. Very many state's attorneys, indeed, regard prosecutions for vice as worse than a mere waste of time, as positively demoralizing proceedings, doing far more harm in the exposure of their details than any number of convictions can do of good. They point to the undoubted fact that vicious stories of the imagination are among the surest and most deadly agencies of corruption. They admit that stories of crime and prosecutions for crime involve the same peril for the young and unsophisticated. But they insist that, just as we cannot live without prosecuting crime, so we cannot stop the publication of sensational narratives about crime and its detection. And they point to the fact that whatever indirect temptation to a criminal career may be held out in the Dime series and others of that ilk by the portrayal of its exciting and perilous incidents, yet in the end the villain gets his deserts, and so the spirit of these narratives is moral after all. Whereas the vicious story is written expressly to make wickedness attractive and teach the folly of right-doing. And the opinion that prosecutions for vice are worse than futile, and even when successful, do more harm than good, is by no means confined to policemen and state's attorneys. It is held by nearly every thoughtful person whose position brings him into contact with vice in what may be called its endemic as distinguished from its sporadic form. Those who study social environments where vice is normal and open and involves no manner of ostracism, and where virtue is considered rather a soppy thing if discovered, and such environments were in Nineveh and shall be in every community till the end, these students know, as well as the policeman and the state's attorney, that vice laughs at prosecutions and recognizes them as valuable advertisements of its business. These last observations lead us naturally to consider a more objectionable feature about prosecutions for vice than their inherent weakness, of which enough has now been said. It may be doubted if public policy justifies the frequent spectacle of the state's power baffled by the force of circumstances and vainly beating the air in a hopeless conflict with things altogether beyond its control. But the case becomes much stronger if we can show that the proceedings are not merely useless and ineffective from the weakness of their nature, but that they are inherently demoralizing, that they not only accomplish no good, but do actually result in evil. This evil is threefold: to the instigators and agents of the prosecution, to the prosecuted, morally, not financially evil to these last, and to the community at large.
It will not probably be disputed that the special agents of a society for setting others straight would be better employed, so far as they themselves are concerned, in almost any other work than that of the detective. Whatever the character of their business, judged by the end in contemplation, the manner of it involves, by the common consent, a severe strain on the manhood, integrity, and honor of its followers. If not necessarily demoralizing, it is a business that tends to demoralization. That the end in contemplation, however lofty, cannot be depended on to counteract the demoralizing influences of the business is sufficiently attested by the occasional convictions of special agents for blackmail. And no man who knows the almost pitiful readiness of vice of certain kinds to submit to bleeding from any quarter can doubt that there are numerous instances of extortion practiced by these men which never come to light. But the special agent is a hired servant, and however devious his ways, doubtless secures by them a living for somebody at home. This excuse, or apology, or what you will, is lacking for the volunteer detective, who, sometimes on his own behalf, sometimes as the present or prospective head of a society for setting others straight, goes slumming in order to appear in the role of an instigator of prosecutions for vice. The only professional reformer who is willing to do his own detective work is, strangely enough, the clerical professional reformer. And, without exception, so far as the writer is aware, he is connected with one or another of the sects that are dominated by the spirit of Brownism, is, in fact, a representative of the Brownist church militant. The motives which impel the Brownist cleric to go slumming are probably of a mixed character. Dispassionate judgment will not exclude curiosity as a factor, though it may be a minor one. A young man, piously reared, who entered the ministry too young to have become familiar with the seamy side of life, may not unnaturally welcome a call of duty to investigate matters of real social and human interest, concerning which he knows nothing except by hearsay. A morbid craving after newspaper notoriety, that peculiar and most embarrassing moral weakness of our age, is surely a prime incentive to clerical slumming. Let us admit the presence of a sincere desire to do good, and a sincere conviction that it may be done by slumming, and by telling tales of slumming to people who do not slum. The question is, does or does not this conviction argue a want of moral balance, only to be made the more pronounced by conduct based upon it? Let us see. As the business of the state is with crime, so the business of the church is with vice. To war against vice is the cleric's function. It is perfectly immaterial whether the vice is also crime or not, so far as his duty is concerned. Dishonesty is always a vice, but many a man has cheated his creditors under the forms of law, that is, without committing any crime. Ingratitude is a vice, but it can never be made a crime, and so on. To war against vice is the cleric's function. But how, in what field, with what weapons? In the field of the soul, with the weapons of the spirit. No array of texts need be cited to prove that the master's soldiers can win for him no other field and use no other weapons with his sanction. The proposition is not disputed by anybody. But the extent to which it is ignored in practice by many who profess to believe in him and to have his cause at heart is startling to see. And by none is it more completely ignored than by the slumming cleric. What is his object at best in slumming? Discovery? By no means. Ignorant as he may be of details, of which more hereafter, he knows that vices exist, and it is silly to pretend that he cannot adequately wield the sword of the spirit placed in his hands against them without a personal knowledge of their manifestations. As well claim this in the case of dishonesty as in the case of any other vice, and seek preparation for the duty of instructing and persuading men to be true and just in all their dealings by frequenting the company of burglars, forgers, and sneak thieves. No, the sword of the Spirit is not sharpened by slumming. The slumming clergyman, in fact, must be more or less than human if his sword be not tarnished and its edge dulled by the filth and miasm of the moral atmosphere through which the wearer flounders in his slumming hours. No, the slumming cleric is not trying to discover vice. There can be no discovery of that which everybody knows exists and has always existed. What he is after is not to discover vice, but to locate it. This he has persuaded himself that it is his duty as a clergyman to do, crediting him, as before, with the highest motive as the conclusive one. But why does he conceive it to be his duty to locate vice? If he keeps his knowledge to himself, it can hurt or help nobody but himself. If he makes a public disclosure of it, he must admit that he is advertising vice, as well as serving as a sort of directory to places where it may be indulged in. If he privately communicates his slumming experiences to the state's officers, any action on their part must be followed by the same advertising, and the slumming cleric, sooner or later, must do his part as a witness to spread abroad the offensive story. Now, this action is just what the brownest cleric that goes slumming boasts of as his desire. He wants to provoke and set in motion the action of the state. He wants to lead a movement. He says, "This sword of the master's spirit is of no use in my hands. Give me a policeman's club that I may pound vice out of the people, and nippers to fasten on their wrists that I may drag them into the straight and narrow way of righteousness." But all this is the union of church and state in the very teeth of the master's teaching, and the speaker is demoralized, and his slumming is demoralizing to him.
For the master's law is the law of morals, and nothing but demoralization can come of such a total misconception of the functions and duty of his ministers as the inclusion therein of active intermeddling in state administration. When the slumming cleric preaches his disclosures, he chooses some such text as "Cry aloud and spare not," a command addressed under the old dispensation to the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah 58, verse 1. These words were actually made the basis of a series of sensational sermons and called "A Command to Us," that is, to Christian ministers, by a Baltimore victim of Parkhurstism who was overcome by the malady about the time of the present writing. He forgets that he is ostensibly the representative of one concerning whom it was written by that same prophet, "He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street." Isaiah 42, verse 2. He forgets that while the function of these old prophets was essentially political, the functions of those who preach the master of a kingdom not of this world are exclusively spiritual. It was the will that the prophets should direct the civil contention against disintegrating social forces. It is the will that Christian clergymen shall put on public men the spiritual armor of clean and invulnerable consciences, and leave them, thus arrayed, to battle with temptation. In nothing was that sweet reasonableness of the master more strikingly manifested than in his insistence on the absolute separation of church and state, the refraining of his ministers from active intermeddling as such in civil administration. This great principle, indeed, bears the copyright stamp of Christianity as taught by its founder. All the great pagan thinkers of antiquity regarded some sort of a union between church and state as essential to the preservation of social order. It was a striking experience of the writers, sometime since, to hear this old pagan idea gravely urged by Christian clergymen before the House Committee on the Chicago Exposition. The question was, shall the exposition be open on Sunday? One Christian preacher after another protested in all seriousness that Christianity could not live without recognition by government, and that the government would fall to pieces unless it recognized Christianity. This was the exact view that the pagan philosopher took of the matter. If a good-natured one of these had just been made ruler over this country, and those preachers talked that way before him, he would not even have embarrassed them and set them flying at each other's throats by demanding that they should first settle among themselves what they meant by Christianity,
before they called upon him as the government to recognize it. The Emperor Julian did this and egged on the disputants till there was a free fight all around, and then ordered his officers to clear the room. But Julian was ill-natured. Our good-natured pagan philosopher would say to these Christian preachers, "Recognize your religion? Religion of most of the people, ain't it? That settles it. Wise statesmanship requires that the religion of the people shall be recognized by the state. We'll arrange to subsidize you all out of the tax fund soon. Anything else you would like in the way of recognition? Just mention it to me. And, by the way, one recognition deserves another. Of course, you will tell the people that I am the government by the grace of God, and that all they have to do is to be good and discharge their duty as my subjects in that state of life unto which it hath pleased God to call them. And keep it always before them that if they don't behave themselves and do just as they are bid, I will hang them here, and you will see to it that they are properly roasted hereafter."
But the sweet reasonableness of the master in this matter admitted of no such bargain as this. The religion he taught could not, from its very nature, receive any benefit from state recognition, or be hampered by the lack thereof. The sphere of its operation lies in a domain where the state's influence is powerless for good or evil, where its force cannot be exercised, where its writs do not run. Plate glass is not so surely proof against the electric current as the sphere of the master's religion is proof against any force which the state's machinery can set in operation. That sphere is the mind and heart of man. Everyone should read that interesting book, Ecce Homo, in order to appreciate the striking peculiarity which distinguishes the master from all other great moral teachers of the race, namely, his comparative indifference to conduct except as indicia of motives, his refusal to accept actions of any sort as meritorious in themselves, and his imperious insistence on his right to dominion over our very thoughts and to set up his kingdom within you. The Brownist clergyman who appeared before the Congressional Committee on the Chicago Fair, of course, defied the master's wisdom and his expressed will when they asked for federal recognition of his religion. The Brownist clergyman who, as the result of his slumming, intermeddles as a clergyman in the work of civil administration, is nonetheless guilty of the same defiance. The master was all wise as well as all good. If he proclaimed the absolute separation of his religion from the state, it was because that separation was absolutely necessary in order that his religion might do the work for the sake of which he revealed it to men. We have seen that his religion was intended to operate within a domain where the state could never render it the slightest assistance. But no one grasped, as did the master, the great and vital truth that it was within the power of the state to exclude his religion altogether from its proper sphere, to emasculate it, devitalize it, paralyze it, so that it could not enter the minds and hearts of men and dominate them. And no one has ever grasped, as did the master, the equally great and vital truth that it was not at all the hostility, but altogether the friendship, the recognition of the state which threatened the life and work of his religion. History has vindicated his position. The rack and the stake have never availed to check the steady conquest by the master's teaching of the minds and hearts of men. But once the church is established by law, and just so far as, directly or indirectly, she is recognized by the state, her energies are gone. She lies helpless at the door of men's hearts and minds, which she cannot enter, and all they that pass by mock at her humiliation. It is deserved. She has cast away the sword of the master's spirit, with which he armed her, and taken instead the policeman's club, which never yet opened the door of the mind and heart of man. It is, of course, an all-sufficient objection to any recognition of the master's religion by the state that it is contrary to his commands and destructive of his religion. But its effects on the state are quite as baleful as are its effects on the church. If it does not destroy the state's power, it turns it in directions the most undesirable, perverts legislation, makes government an instrument of evil instead of a benefit to men.
Experience shows that ecclesiasticism never intermeddles with civil administration without serious injury to the welfare of the community. And what is true of such intermeddling by an organized church or body of ecclesiastics is nonetheless true when the intermeddling is practiced by individual clerics as such. Richelieu may be cited to the contrary. But Richelieu was one of those exceptions that prove the rule, that is to say, an exception viewed superficially, which on closer scrutiny turns out to be no exception at all. For Richelieu, though a cleric, did not intermeddle with civil administration as such. He was at once a cardinal and a statesman. But he was a great statesman and invaluable to his country just by reason of his ability, in the exercise of his splendid powers of statesmanship, to ignore his clerical character altogether, and wherever an irrepressible conflict arose, to subordinate the interests of his church to the interests of his country.
Our modern clergy are not Richelieus, and of them collectively and individually, the proposition stands that their intermeddling as such with the civil administration is pregnant of confusion and disaster. Our Brownist clerics who go slumming and seek to effect a union of church and state through the instrumentality of societies for setting others straight proceed on the assumption that their intermeddling with the civil administration must result in good, because they are about the master's business when they engage in such intermeddling. We have seen that they are not about his business at such times, but are taking on themselves the particular business of the Hebrew prophets, a political business of the kind that the master expressly declared to be none of his. If they were really imbued with the sweet reasonableness of the master whom they profess to serve, they would recognize the wisdom of his inhibition in this regard as applied to themselves individually, as well as in its application to organized churches. They would see that it is in vain for them to expect his guidance in a work undertaken in his name, which he has expressly said shall not be undertaken in his name. And a very little reflection would convince them that without such guidance, without superhuman and miraculous direction at every step, their intermeddling with the civil administration must inevitably prove disastrous to the state. This certainly results from the nature of the conditions with which civil administration has to deal, and from the mental attitude of the intermeddlers with reference thereto. The conditions are complicated in the extreme. Interests equally worthy of subservience, both on equitable and political grounds, are frequently irreconcilable. Compromises and modi vivendi have to be availed of at every turn, in the making as in the enforcement of the laws. And wise administration must forever feel its way along to its true end, the greatest good of the greatest number.
The clerical intermeddler in such business is almost sure to make mischief by reason of his ignorance. The most fanatical Brownist cleric would not assume that because he is a cleric, therefore he knows more about diseases of the body and the management of hospitals than those who have devoted their lives to the study and practical investigation of these matters. But the theory of civil administration has engaged the attention of the wise and prudent through all the ages, and its capacity for improvement by thought and experiment is admittedly not yet exhausted, though the general preservation of good order and the general security of lives and property in civilized countries are the best evidence that the means are not wholly unadapted to the ends. And while investigation and right reason and experience will doubtless lead to the adoption of more effective means from time to time, it is clear that there is little likelihood of any valuable suggestion herein coming from a person who is absolutely ignorant of the subject and has neither made a study of the writings of great publicists nor had the benefit of a practical acquaintance with the conditions which must be dealt with. And this is precisely the case with the clerical intermeddler in civil administration. Hence, as there has never been the smallest light shed upon the subject from a clerical source in the past, so there is not the slightest prospect that we shall ever receive any enlightenment upon it from a clerical source in the future. The education and the experience of a cleric qualify him as well to practice medicine and surgery as to give advice on a question of civil administration. But in the first case, as his ignorance alone would be dangerous, there would always be a possibility, however remote, that he might do the right thing in some emergency.
There is a story that when the would-be assassin, Payne, cut the face of Mr. Staunton with his hatchet as the minister lay ill in bed, he made a gash which the surgeons had feared to make and thereby relieved the patient of an accumulation of pus which was endangering his life. So the Brownist cleric, in dealing with the sick, as he would have no particular prejudice in favor of one course of treatment over another and would simply be blundering blindly, would have at least a chance of sometimes blundering on the proper procedure. Nor would there be wanting, to save him from hasty conclusions and rash action, a wholesome consciousness of his own ignorance and mistrust of his own capacity to deal with the conditions before him.
But now take our cleric from the hospital and put him into the civil administration. Here it is not merely 1,000 to 1 that he will go wrong, it is impossible that he should go right. The danger, of course, is many times greater from his ignorance than in the first case, because now he is not only unconscious of his ignorance, but actually believes that he is acting under the inspiration of special wisdom from on high. Hence he will now blunder not blindly, but wildly, recklessly, without hesitation, without anxiety, without remorse. But that he must blunder wildly and recklessly is no more certain than that he must always blunder. For now he blunders blindly no longer. He blunders with his eyes wide open and his vision all distorted. He no longer feels his way in the dark without prejudice for one route over another. He follows a light which is an ignis fatuus that is sure to lead him and those who go with him into a hopeless morass. And this ignis fatuus is the union of church and state so emphatically repudiated by the master, and, what is more, the union of the state and the particular church which the clerical intermeddler happens to prefer to the other churches. In his profound and suggestive work on The Study of Sociology, Mr. Herbert Spencer shows how necessary it is for any right and profitable thinking on public topics that the thinker should be altogether free from bias or prejudice of any kind. He develops here and elsewhere the correct conception of human government or civil administration as a machine. To properly determine the purposes to which the proposed machinery of government ought to be adapted, and then to properly construct and manage the machinery, requires the scientific cast of mind, that is to say, a mind which approaches the conditions to be dealt with, free from preconceptions, recalling impartially the experiences of the past, ready at any moment to receive suggestions from the phenomena of the present. One of the most valuable chapters on The Study of Sociology is one dealing with the theological bias, under the influence whereof the clerical intermeddler always approaches a question of civil administration, and which, as Mr. Spencer shows, is utterly incompatible with the scientific state of mind, and therefore renders it unthinkable that his intermeddling should be otherwise than hurtful. This theological bias causes the clerical intermeddler to take false and unscientific views for which the governmental machinery should be designed, and also of the principles on which it should be constructed and managed, of the purposes for which it should be designed, because he would have it regulate human conduct with the view to men's happiness in the next world, whereas its sole proper concern is to regulate that conduct in the way which will the least interfere with the attainment of the greatest possible happiness by the greatest possible number of people in this world. Because he would have it applied to the greatest good of his own particular religious denomination and its members, and its application to the greatest good of any one portion of the community is inconsistent with that purpose of the greatest good to the greatest number, which is the true purpose of governmental machinery. Because he would have it run upon the assumption that the religion of his denomination is superior as a religion to all others, and to adopt such an assumption as this is to recognize and prefer one religion to another, to establish a union of church and state, all of which is inconsistent with the right purpose of civil government. But the theological bias is no less fatal to right and serviceable thinking about the principles upon which the machinery of government is based than it is to right and profitable thinking about the purposes for which it should be designed, and with a view to which it should be managed. The government is a machine. Like all other machines, to be a good machine, it must be constructed on scientific principles.
These principles require a reference to facts, not theories. One of the most important things to be considered in the construction of any machine is the materials of which it must be made and the materials upon which it is to operate. Now, scientific principles require that in the construction of our governmental machinery, we shall have regard to the facts of the materials of both kinds, and not to any theories concerning them. The scientific builder or alterer of a machine studies these materials as they are and gives no thought to the question of what they ought to be. He does not say to himself, "Here is material out of which I am to make a saw. The metal is very soft, but it ought to be hard, and so I will make the saw in such a manner that it will be a very good saw indeed, if the metal ever becomes hard." He does not say, "Here are certain logs which I am to make a saw cut. The wood is very hard, but it ought to be soft. So I will make such a saw as will cut it easily enough, if the wood should ever become soft." But the effect of the theological bias is to produce just this unscientific attitude of mind toward the construction and alteration of the machinery of government. The material out of which the machinery must be constructed, and that on which it must operate, is human nature. It is true that the business of the clergyman is with human nature, but the business of the geologist and the analytical chemist may be alike with strata and ores, and yet the training and profession of one would not qualify him to deal scientifically with the problems that lie within the domain of the other. It is easy enough to see how the training and profession of a clergyman not only do not tend to qualify him, but inevitably incapacitate him from taking a right view of the principles upon which the governmental machinery should be constructed. That training and profession necessarily and rightly commit him to a view of human nature framed with reference to what it ought to be, rather than to what it is. Necessarily and rightly, because his business is to teach men what they ought to do, and to induce them by sweet and soft persuasion to do it. But the business of the government is not to teach men what they ought to do, but what they must do, or be punished for not doing. Here we have another illustration of the principle that law, or the government, has nothing to do with immorality, but deals with incivility alone. What men ought to do is the same on a small island where there is no government at all, as it is in a great republic with the most complex system of several governments, federal, state, municipal, whatnot, that can be imagined. The work of the clergyman, then, is, in a sense, above that of the government. It would exist, though no government existed. It would remain, though all government should perish. But the clergyman's work is done when persuasion and exhortation have failed. The clergyman cannot judge, because the master has declared that though a man shall refuse to receive his word, yet he judges not that man. The clergyman cannot punish, because the master has said, "Put up again thy sword into his place. For all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." And here the government steps in. It has nothing to do with persuasion or exhortation. It wastes no time in trying to convince the citizen that he ought to do this or ought not to do that. It is perfectly indifferent to his views upon the subject. It simply commands him to do or refrain, as the case may be, and judges and punishes him in its own way for disobedience. The spheres of clerical and governmental action being thus entirely distinct, the relation of the two to the material of human nature is also distinct, and the clergyman is not merely non-qualified, but disqualified, so far as government is concerned, by reason of his calling and profession, from taking a scientific view of the material out of which government must be constructed and on which it must operate. This fatal result of the theological bias, as affecting the clerical notion of the construction and management of government, is a frequent manifestation. The clerical intermeddler in civil administration would have special agents endowed with inquisitorial powers to dog the footsteps and enter at will the houses of citizens. and he is deaf to the suggestion that the material of which special agents are made is human nature, and that inquisitorial powers in such material bring forth blackmail. He answers rightly enough, they ought not to bring forth blackmail, and feels satisfied that the legislation he urges, since it ought to result in good, is wise, though it actually results in evil.
Again, this intermeddler, seeing that men need watching and guiding from the cradle to the grave, as indeed they do, and we know who has promised to watch and guide them, if they will, would fain entrust the government with this function. Nobody will dispute with him that this would be a good thing to do, if only we had the material to do it with. A perfect government might safely and advantageously be entrusted with all the destinies of the race, with powers unlimited and most minute. But, unfortunately, the only material available for us out of which to construct a government is human nature, and human nature is not perfect. If we may return to the metaphor of the log, we may say that here is a log called government, under which we must crawl for shelter from the storms of disorder and anarchy. But let us not delude ourselves with the idea that the wood is soft and plastic, that it will lie lightly upon us and adapt itself, without effort on our part, to our convenience and comfort. Nor let us be tempted, for the sake of a little more shelter or convenience, to remove one single prop which helps to keep it from falling and crushing the life out of us. And this is just what clerical intermeddling in civil administration by organization and individuals has in all ages done for mankind. It has crushed them at every point. Falsely assuming that this sheltering mass called government is soft and plastic and light of weight, its constant endeavor is to bring it down on every joint of the citizen, so that his own will shall not affect one single movement of his body, and his liberty and individuality shall be annihilated forever. The clerical intermeddler, then, cannot be otherwise than an ill suggester concerning the construction of governmental machinery, because he cannot but take an unscientific view of the material used in its construction, considered with relation to the machinery. But the machinery is to operate on other material of the same sort which is not used in its construction, and his view of the relation between this material and the governmental machinery is also fatally unscientific, and is rendered so by reason of his training and profession. For these lead him, more or less unconsciously, yet inevitably, to confuse the power of the government with the power of the universe, and to impute to the civil machinery the omnipotence of the deity.
He is never free from the influence of the Hebrew theocracy, can never wholly rid himself of the notion that thus saith the Lord is, somehow or other, the real meaning of the words "be it enacted," with which our modern statutes begin. And as the only civil government which he has ever really studied was divinely inspired and guided, so the spiritual government which he serves is absolute. The law he deals with is no sooner spoken than it is done. More or less unconsciously, our clerical intermeddler transfers to the civil machinery the idea of absolute power, as well as of divine inspiration. If he concludes that it would be a good thing for men to do this or that, he at once clamors for a law requiring them to do this or that. In vain is it represented to him that public policy forbids the passage of any law which cannot be reasonably enforced, that no law can be reasonably enforced which is not sustained by an overwhelming public opinion in its favor, and that, however desirable it may seem to him that men should do this or that, yet the public opinion of the community is overwhelmingly against doing this or that. Divine will he sees in the enactment of the law. Divine power he relies on for its enforcement. He will have this governmental machinery set about work which every publicist of scientific mind will prove to him through reason and history it can never, by any possibility, accomplish. Clerical intermeddling with civil administration has been particularly conspicuous of late in this country, and the result which the considerations just adduced would lead us to anticipate
has been fully realized in practice. We have on our statute books a large and constantly increasing number of laws, saturated with the spirit of paternalism, dealing with things altogether beyond the domain and reach of the civil power. Violently opposed to the overwhelming opinion of the communities, from their very nature unenforceable, and by their manifest and often grotesque futility, bringing scorn upon all law and begetting a natural and wholesome contempt for the inspirers and enactors of such absurd and oppressive regulations. The clerical intermeddler in civil affairs, then, like the Sunday of which he is the originator and conservator, so far as his influence is manifested in actual legislation or official activity, is an unmitigated evil and a demoralizer altogether.